He connects the poverty and famine of those childlike heathens living in Rupert's Land, the Métis, and other indigenous nations. He says that their poverty that they're suffering from is a blessing from God that will make them humble, ready to cry out to God and to receive deliverance. So this was a common trope employed, that if you were poor, you know, living in an inner city slum, it was because God was trying to humble you and make you dependent on God. So likewise, communities that were suffering from famines, it was because God was trying to awaken them. So Bishop Anderson employed this rhetoric to invoke paternalistic pity, probably, in the London audience, to grieve for, quote, the poor Indian who was hunger-stricken, but full of hope despite being in the wilderness. So the sermon ends with a call, of course, for donations to the building of British-style schools for these children. So Britain's answer to the nations. So as you can see in my presentation, I'm kind of talking all about the theology and the mindset that went in to the residential schools, right? This was their whole worldview of why they were constructing these. And so this sermon was published and it was sold all over the British Empire. And so these words were, you know, being consumed, and the intention of Bishop Anderson, he says in his own sermon, is to represent the case of my far distant diocese of Rupert's Land, the wants of the Indian of the wilderness, and Rupert's Land as the center of light in civilization. So depicting the wants and so-called depravity of the Indians was part of how Bishop Anderson raised the funds to continue and to further his civilizing project. So in the 19th century, British imaginary wealth was moralized. So poverty was considered a moral weakness or an idleness, stupidity, and was even connected in literature to sexual deviance. So this lens of viewing the material cultures of indigenous people as fundamentally poor furthered the colonial agenda, because indigenous people in British North America didn't mine coal in a capitalist context. Colonial powers therefore were entitled to resource extract. So the powers grew wealthier and wealthier off of extraction, whereas indigenous peoples were often forced into labor. And of course weren't paid well. So the rhetoric of this sermon facilitated categories of persons, and it shows how the British are seen as the light of the nations and how indigenous peoples are rendered those that are helpless. So whiteness in this way becomes essential, the essential marker of social responsibility. And the construction of race was implicit in the moral imperative of civilizing the wild. So during this era, the rhetoric of white racial destiny and entitlement became increasingly dominant, and it was held up against the unruly, wild Métis hunter, characterized especially in Gabriel Dumont. And if you want another time, I can tell you all about how after Dumont was chased out of Canada, he was given a job on the Wild West show, where he got to perform being native for the whole world. After the buffalo had run out, it was the only way he could make money. So in British North America, the true citizen was conceptualized as the white working farming male, whereas the East Asian workers were referred to in this Canada First literature as the yellow evil, and indigenous peoples were often dehumanized as being wild and sexually unruly and savage. So the missionary project was based on this need to bring civilization to these non-persons, to bring to the, end quote from the sermon, to bring to the cold of the north a protection and a shelter to the needy brother. But in reality, the Métis and other indigenous nations in Rupert's Land, so-called Rupert's Land, were thriving, living very, very successfully off of the buffalo hunt. And it was only through European over-hunting and over-extraction that they then were no longer able to sustain their way of life. And hence, Gabrielle is chased out of the country for mobilizing his community and is put on stage. So Anderson's rhetoric in his sermon talks about this white man's burden and essentially says that in order for the indigenous peoples to become successful, they have to conform and become culturally British. And to be British is considered to be blessed. So converted to Christianity, their first duty was to become industrious, temperate, independent, able to financially support the church. So to be a good citizen was essentially, in the Red River, was to be a farmer and also to donate to the church. Thus we see that the ideal Christian is essentially the same as being a good citizen. So missionaries promoted the empire through the moralized project of expanding Christian civilization. And part of the Anglican concern in Rupert's Land was that the indigenous peoples shouldn't be able to govern themselves. And this became particularly evident in the decade leading up to Confederation. In carving out the West through civilizing the wild, the Anglican missions prepared the regions for the coming of Canada. They prepared the land and the people for the great civilization project of Confederation. And in 1865, the report of the Diocese of Rupert's Land states that the communities of mostly, quote, Indians and half-breeds with a few Europeans exist in a peculiar social condition. So that the Anglican priests writing these documents, they're really concerned. So despite the populations of Red River being around 12,000 people at this time, and overwhelmingly Métis, almost of those 12,000 people living at Red River, about half of them are Anglo-Métis, so English-speaking, and the other half are Francophone Métis. And so half the community goes to the Catholic Church, and half of the community goes to the Anglican Church. And the French Catholic priests would go on hunting trips with the Métis, and it was there that, and to be a good Catholic was to participate in the sacraments, so to receive the Eucharist, to baptize your children, get married in the church, things like this. Whereas the Anglican priests didn't go on hunting trips. And for them, to be a good Christian was not as much about participating in the sacrament, but it was about being industrious. So the Anglican missionary style much more pushed for settlement, for the establishment of permanent houses, and the furthering of a English idea of society. And so it was in these missionary schools that the Anglicans really pushed, especially during this time. The Catholics did also build schools, but the Anglicans were much stronger in pushing for settlement. They quote said, that their Britannic race and its civilization could be furthered through settlement and clergy teaching the indigenous peoples in school. The clergy taught the Anglo-Métis that their dilution of their, quote, Britannic race and its civilization was being degraded by their Indian blood. So the Anglican clergy teaching Anglo-Métis peoples really emphasized their British ancestry, and they said, you guys are part British, you got to reclaim your Britishness, loose your ties with your French cousins, don't follow the buffalo hunt, you need to be settled. That's what it means to be a good British person, which you guys almost are, you're almost there. So this kind of thing. And even in some of the writings of these priests, they talk about their attempt to reform the, quote, raw settlement of Métis. So the English clergy were instrumental in the settlement of the Anglo-Métis. And Reverend Jones, a priest at this time, he refused to minister to those that were hunters. So he wouldn't give the sacrament to Anglo-Métis who were hunters. because of their, quote, idleness. Isn't that fascinating? So, because they were busy hunting, you know, they weren't being good men. They needed to farm. So this demonstrates the moralization of settled life as being good versus hunting, which is bad. So hunting was seen as something savage, even though, you know, everybody was eating chickens and stuff, but for some reason this is how they conceptualize masculinity. So Métis masculinity, and Gabriel Dumont is kind of, in our public imagination, he's like the pinnacle of Métis masculinity. It was one that honored hunting and trapping, whereas the missionaries identified these activities as self-indulgent and leisurely. So Anglican priests tended to see themselves, unlike the Catholic priests, as much more ambassadors of empire, who held strong beliefs often in white supremacy. And organizations like Canada First promoted white supremacist beliefs. So Red River Anglican priest Reverend William Cochran often preached a theology that emphasized the God-given superiority of the English civilization. And he encouraged the Métis of his congregation to, quote, pull off the wild by getting them to abandon their indigenous identity, especially expressed through hunting. So this rhetoric was also applied to Métis women, who in Red River began to be seen and spoken about as the epitome of the sexualized, wild, uncivilized half-breed and a danger to the purification of the English race. So during the mid-19th century, English men had come to the Red River, and they'd married Métis women. But during this time, as more Anglos were coming to the region, they began to leave and abandon their wives in favor of new white English school teachers that were being brought from England to the community. So it's really interesting, the literature at this time, we have this whole generation of guys essentially abandoning their Métis wives and children and taking on new wives from the English community. And from this class, they generated a new white Anglo social elite, comprised of the Anglican clergy and gentlemen with their white wives that had displaced the half-breed women. Part of this emergent class was Anglican priests, the Reverend Corbett. And like Reverend Cochran, he insisted that the Anglo-Métis leave beside their indigenous identity and assume a British identity. And this priest, Corbett, instigated tensions between the English and French Métis. And he preached to his community and said that you guys, as Anglo-Métis, are superior because you're not French. And so he encouraged them to cut ties and to not do business with the French Métis and to see themselves as superior to them. And this was being taught to kids, too. So this is really fascinating research that the Anglican clergy tried to literally drive a wedge between the French and English Métis. And before this time, there was huge integration, huge crossover between the English and French Métis. As I said, the Métis were known for being able to speak so many languages and being culturally fluent in different avenues and being really able to party across lines. And they were known for their music and dancing. And so the community of Red River was very blended, but during this time, during this time leading up to Confederation is a time of competing nationalisms and the consolidation of racial identities. And so the idea of being British, like I said, and the expansion of these social clubs, Canada First literature, etc., to be British was everything. And British supremacy became like an inherent part of Anglican religious identity. So in 1867, under the British North America Act, Quebec, Ontario, Nova Scotia, and New Brunswick were now yoked together as the Dominion of Canada. The Rupert's Land Act transferred the Hudson's Bay Company's region, which was all of Rupert's Land, it was owned. So the king got it through the doctrine of discovery, you know, read a thing, I own this land here in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost, and then eventually sold Rupert's Land to the Hudson's Bay Company and then bought Rupert's Land from the Hudson's Bay Company into the Dominion of Canada. And this act was passed back in England in 1868. And so entrance of British Columbia into the Dominion was contingent on the building of a coast-to-coast railway. So in order for BC to get linked to this bizarre eastern conglomeration of provinces, they said, we're only coming in to the Dominion if you build us a railway. Now, why would you want a railway to connect coast to coast? Resource extraction. So it's all about the flow of commerce. So if you read between the lines, I'm kind of saying that the construction of Canada was about resource extraction. But really, Britain said, we are only coming in if you build us a railway. And this was really to flow resources from the west to the east and to further trade. So this, quote, train of iron became the principal agent in steamrolling Confederation to the west.